I would like to thank Jan and Madison, I think, first of all, for helping to organize such a wonderful and promising conference. Also, my partners in crime, David and Scott, and I think we really have an impressive conference ahead of us. I'm looking forward to the rest of the papers. I'd also like to thank Frank for giving me a new title for my paper. Originally, in the program, it's In Defense of the Nation, Protectionism and Boycotts in Central and Eastern Europe. Another title could well be Vacuum of National Sovereignty, Protectionism and Boycotts in Central and Eastern Europe. Any discussion of economic nationalism in Central and Eastern Europe must begin with Friedrich List, the 19th century German economist who is best known for his advocacy of trade protectionism. In his magnum opus, The National System of Political Economy, which was published between 1841 and 44, revised a couple times, List objected to the laissez-faire policies of economic liberalism, singling out free trade for particularly sharp criticism. Free trade, he argued, stimulated economic growth in countries with internationally competitive industrial sectors, but it actually impeded economic growth in countries whose backward economies were based on the export of agricultural goods. Unless something could be done to level the playing field, untrammeled free trade would only widen the economic gap between industrialized and agricultural countries, making it well nigh impossible for the latter to catch up. In an effort to correct the imbalance, List proposed that agricultural countries actively develop new branches of industry, using protective tariffs to shield these branches until they became internationally competitive. This measure, known as infant industry tariff protection, is the cornerstone of List's economic policy, and not surprisingly, it was widely cited by the national protectionist associations and national boycott movements in Central and Eastern Europe that will be the subject of my talk. List's dispute with economic liberals is often reduced to simple policy differences, free trade versus protectionism. But as the political economist Eric Heliner has argued, List's real dispute with Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Richard Cobden was about the importance of the nation. These economic liberals were above all cosmopolitans, and their primary frame of reference was not the nation, but rather humanity or mankind. For them, free trade was not just a means for promoting economic prosperity, but in the words of John Stuart Mill, it was nothing less than, quote, the principal guarantee of the peace of the world, end quote. This may sound like a rather audacious or even utopian claim, but economic liberals believed that free trade could create ties of interdependence that would in turn foster a peaceful world community. In the words of Richard Cobden, free trade will, quote, act on the moral world as the principle of gravitation in the universe, drawing men together, thrusting aside any antagonism of race and creed and language, and uniting us in the bonds of eternal peace, end quote. For Friedrich List, however, such boundless cosmopolitanism ignored the fact that the world was divided into nations at different and unequal stages of industrialization, each with distinctive and often competing national interests. While free trade might be advantageous for Britain, home to the above-mentioned economic liberals, it was an impediment for latecomers to industrialization, such as the German Confederation, where List was from, or the Habsburg Empire or the Russian Empire. And because List viewed the nation and not humanity as the most salient and meaningful collective community, he insisted that economic policy should not only aim to increase a nation's economic prosperity, but also to bolster a nation's culture and power. For him, trade protectionism was a means to multiple ends, developing a robust national economy and at the same time strengthening national pride, glory, and self-sufficiency. List's policy recommendations were developed primarily with sovereign nation states in mind, hence the importance of this idea of the vacuum of national sovereignty. But they found particular resonance in the multinational and multi-confessional Habsburg Empire, where economic life was largely stratified along national or confessional lines. I hesitate to use the term nation in this period, in the course of the 19th century, because many of the nations that emerged out of the ruins of the Habsburg Empire were still being imagined and constructed in the middle of the 19th century. And as the Hungarian case will demonstrate, economic nationalism was an integral part of the nation-building process. In the 1840s, Hungary was part of the Habsburg Empire, or Austrian Empire it's also called, and nationalists such as the later revolutionary Lajos Kossuth hoped to reduce Hungary's colonial dependence on Austria, in part by modernizing its backward agricultural economy and cultivating new branches of industry. In 1846, 2 years before the revolution, Kossuth wrote the following. "Anyone who interprets the term nation according to the criteria of the 19th century must be aware of the fact that those who do not possess the independent levers of civilization are only a people or race, but cannot be treated as a nation. Among these levers, the most significant ones are trade and the manufacturing industries. Without them, one can exist as a country, but not as a nation. And we Hungarians want to be considered as a nation by the standards of the present century." Kossuth was strongly influenced by Liszt, who had visited Hungary in 1842, and whose book, The National System of Political Economy, had been published in Hungarian already in 1843. A protective tariff was not an option within the internal borders of the Habsburg Empire, because again, Hungary did not have national sovereignty and did not have control over its own borders. So Kossuth and his associates resorted to another form of protectionism, namely a boycott of imported goods. I guess a boycott avant la lettre, because this is 1844. In 1844, they established the Országos Védegylet, the National Protective Association, whose members pledged not to buy foreign, that is Austrian, manufactured goods for a period of 6 years. Keep in mind that this is part of the same empire, so when they talk about foreign, they're actually talking about the ruling powers. The association was introduced by one of its founders in the following terms. "Under different conditions, we would have resorted to the instrument of protective tariff for the advancement of national welfare. However, under the present conditions, our only hope lies in the tenacity of our fellow citizens. Since we cannot establish customs protection on our borders, we will have to set up ramparts at the thresholds of our own homes," end quote. In word and image, the founders of the National Protective Association portrayed it as a purely defensive organization. And its slogan, "Buy Hungarian," appealed first and foremost to a sense of affirmative national pride. Within a few months, over 100,000 people signed up, and even if the association's economic impact was quite limited, it gave momentum to a separatist ethos that characterized Hungarian nationalism until the dissolution of the Habsburg Empire. If economic liberalism was about creating ties of interdependence, then economic nationalism was about severing ties of interdependence by building separate, self-sufficient, or autarkic national economies. In Central and Eastern Europe, where the truncated class structure of many peasant-based nations left essential branches of the economy, such as credit and commerce, in the hands of other national or confessional groups, this meant that building a fully-fledged national economy often entailed driving out members of other national or confessional groups. One of the principal institutions in this exclusionary nation-building process was the credit or trade cooperative, a kind of community self-help association that aimed to eliminate middlemen and intermediaries from the emerging market economy. As Torsten Lorenz has observed in a recent volume on this subject, cooperatives in Eastern Europe were, quote, "tightly interwoven with the national movements and seen by their leaders as a tool for strengthening the whole ethnically bordered nation," end quote. Catherine Albrecht, a scholar of the Bohemian lands, has shown in the case of the Bohemian lands how the cooperative movement, which began there in the 1850s, contributed to the separation of Czech and German society and to the consolidation of each group around a national principle. Likewise, in Galicia, they contributed to the separation of Polish and Ruthenian society, in Transylvania to the separation of Romanian and Hungarian society, And similar examples abound, including in the multinational western borderlands of the Russian Empire. Of course, in a region where Jews, as a typical middleman minority, were highly concentrated in money lending and trade, anti-Semitism came to play an outsized role in the cooperative movement, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century. Credit cooperatives were founded in large part to supply secure and affordable credit to the rural poor, who had no other source of credit apart from high interest or usurious loans, to use the jargon of the day. Anti-Semites saw usury as the primary evil associated with the Jews, so even non-anti-Semitic cooperative movements, like the Raiffeisen movement in late 19th century Germany, inevitably shared affinities with openly anti-Semitic cooperative movements due to a shared preoccupation with the fight against usury. Even if Raiffeisen viewed cooperatives as a form of, quote, institutionalized neighborly love and discouraged attacks on Jews, many others joined the cooperative movement with the more aggressive goal of achieving full emancipation from the Jews. This raises a question that may emerge again in the course of our conference. If anti-Semites and non-anti-Semites are motivated by different ideologies that use identical means to achieve an identical goal, can one make a meaningful distinction between them? Or as David Peel put it in his article on cooperative movements in rural Germany, was the Raiffeisen movement simply an example of, quote, anti-Semitism by other means? In the multinational Habsburg Empire, where the battlefronts were increasingly drawn along national, not confessional lines, Jews often found themselves caught between competing nationalities, between Czechs and Germans, Slovaks and Hungarians, Ruthenians and Poles, just to mention a few. And I want to take the case of the Bohemian lands, or today's Czech Republic, as an example. In the first half of the 19th century, one could still speak of an inclusive, territorially defined Bohemian identity in the Bohemian lands. But with the sharpening of national feeling in the second half of the century, Bohemians gradually became Czechs and Germans, two mutually exclusive national groups fighting for their own political, cultural, and economic rights. In mixed language areas, the political, cultural, and economic realms were fully intertwined, turning seemingly mundane decisions, such as which language to speak, which school to send your children to, where to do your shopping, or even which bicycle club to join. These were turned into public declarations of support for one of the competing national movements. Neutrality was not an option, and Jews who were more likely to speak German than Czech were often suspect in the eyes of Czech nationalists. So too were chameleons, as individuals who actively participated in both Czech and German cultural life were derisively called. Indeed, with the hardening of linguistic, cultural, and political boundaries at the end of the 19th century, there was little tolerance or trust for such border crossers. It was in this highly charged context that the boycott campaigns emerged in the Bohemian lands in the 1890s, with the slogans Svoj ke svemu, to each his own, in Czech, and Kauf nur bei den Deutschen, or buy only from Germans, in German. As a rule, these slogans frame the boycott campaigns as defensive measures that drew on traditions of self-help. This was also the case in early 20th century Congress Poland, and we're going to hear about this, I think, tomorrow from Grzegorz Krzywiec, who's going to be talking about the Svoj do swego po swoje movement, and this is a Polish variant of to each his own. In the case of the Bohemian lands, Catherine Albrecht has shown that the anti-Czech boycotts and anti-German boycotts had different purposes and employed different tactics. Bohemian Germans were a beleaguered minority, living in towns and districts that had once been solidly German, but were now facing an onslaught of Czech-speaking newcomers who demanded the right to use the Czech language in public affairs. The German anti-Czech boycott campaign aimed to preserve demographic, cultural, and economic control, and did so by employing rent and employment boycotts intended to keep the Czechs, and by extension, the Czech cultural threat at bay. Czechs, on the other hand, constituted an overwhelming majority in the Bohemian lands, but in the face of the German political and economic elite, They had not yet succeeded in establishing their ultimate goal of economic autarky or self-sufficiency. The anti-German boycott campaign primarily targeted Bohemian German manufacturers, but is also directed at German Jewish retailers who were residing in Czech communities. Like the founders of the Hungarian Országos Védegylet, the Protective Association, the leaders of the anti-German boycott campaign called on Czechs to exercise national discipline and purchase only Czech products. The anti-Czech and anti-German boycott campaigns employed tactics that have become standard practice in boycott campaigns until this day. The campaigns labeled businesses, products, and individuals as Czech or German, often with the help of newspapers that exposed the hidden backgrounds or supposed national sympathies of proprietors, or published lists of people seen shopping at boycotted stores. Nationalist associations established offices to oversee the boycott and published address books that listed Czech or German businesses, indicating which one should be patronized and which one should be boycotted. Signs were also placed in windows declaring businesses to be purely German or purely Czech. And in 1904, the Czech National Council even issued a special stamp to mark Czech goods. There was also a counter stamp that was issued by the one of the German national movements in the Bohemian lands. And 2 years later, in 1906, Hungarian noblewomen and students introduced a tulip-shaped insignia to mark products in Hungary. In some respects, the Czech stamp and the Hungarian tulip can be seen as early attempts at nation branding. Efforts to convince customers to purchase a product or patronize a business, not because of its inherent quality or value, but because of its national origin. In fact, such national branding played a highly important propagandistic role. Even if the quality of a national product was shoddy, the consumer could still find comfort in knowing that he was performing a service to his nation by supporting the growth of a domestic industry. As Rudolf Jaworski has somewhat cynically observed, it was simply easier to claim the uniqueness of one's own national culture than to plausibly demonstrate the productivity and competitiveness of one's own national economy. As contemporaries pointed out, it was also difficult to demonstrate the effectiveness of boycotts in achieving a long-term goal, be it cultural preservation or economic self-sufficiency. A critic of boycott campaigns argued in 1917 that rational market forces would always win out over irrational national sentiments. He summed it up as follows, and this is a translation from the German. In the end, the implementation of a boycott depends on material conditions that are seldom met. As a rule, when selling wares or services, the determining factor is the difference between use value and exchange value. A matter is evaluated based purely on private economic interest and reason, or rationality. The boycott, in contrast, comes from a community as opposed to an individual and makes an appeal to emotion. In some individuals, an inner excitement can be sparked that goes against rational private economic interest. This excitement, however, gradually dissipates, end quote. Seen from this perspective, one could argue that the primary long-term impact of economic boycott was never going to be in the economic sphere. In fact, in the context of the Habsburg Empire and the western borderlands of the Russian Empire, boycott campaigns were a sign of political radicalization that to a large extent acknowledged the failure of self-help associations, credit cooperatives, and gradual industrialization to produce separate self-sufficient national economies in a speedy manner. To paraphrase David Peel, they constituted nationalist politics by other means. One can discern a palpable sense of frustration, even impatience, among the boycott activists in the multinational Habsburg Empire. Frustration at the stunted growth of their putative nations, which were confined to a prison of nations, and thereby unable to develop a fully fledged social structure, a fully fledged national economy, or to use Kossuth's felicitous term, the independent levers of civilization. As subjected peoples without clearly defined territorial borders, or again, to use Frank's term, as people living in a vacuum of national sovereignty, these nations in formation could not introduce protective tariffs, custom protection, or any of Friedrich's policies, which were designed to help sovereign nation states become competitive on the interstate level. In this respect, we can understand boycotts as a tool to help putative nations catch up and become competitive, first on the intra-state level, and then perhaps in the future on the interstate level. The boycott campaign was not necessarily a wholesale rejection of economic liberalism. In fact, it can be seen as an attempt to merely defer economic liberalism until the conditions were ripe for free trade, until a particular national group had obtained the independent levers of civilization necessary to participate in the community of nations on equal terms. In fact, this corresponds with List's stated goal of promoting a nation's economic development with the ultimate goal of, quote, preparing it for admission into the universal society of the future, end quote. Indeed, one can even discern a certain cosmopolitan mindset in List's writings. But for him, the nation, and not humanity, was the most salient collective community, the primary bearer of meaning. He probably would have agreed with Johann Gottlieb Fichte, another economic nationalist, whose words will conclude my paper. And this is a quote, "Cosmopolitanism is the will that the purpose of humanity be really achieved. Patriotism is the will that this purpose be fulfilled in the nation to which we ourselves belong, and that the results spread from it to the whole of humanity. Cosmopolitanism must necessarily become patriotism." Thank you.